You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to stage 25 of The Grandest Tour, or as it's now known, the Preston Bus Station Podcast. We'll get on to that a bit later. My name is Richard Moore and I'm joined tonight by Lionel Butterpie.
Hello, Richard. Oh dear. Oh dear.
And so, and we're also joined by someone who's provocative, mysterious and revered as one of the world's very best exponents of their craft, Banksy. Lizzie Banks.
Hello, Richard. Lovely to be back.
Oh, it's great to have you back, Lizzie. We are going to be talking, as I say, about stage 25 of the Grandest Tour. I've lost count of how many stages we're at in the actual Vuelta.
Stage 10 now, Richard. Yeah, just into the second half of the race today.
We've kind of, one grand tour.
The grand tour's seesaw has tilted in another direction.
One grand tour just rolled into another one, hasn't it? Anyway, it's been a busy day on social media for us, fending off yet more facts and bits of trivia about Preston and about Preston Bus Station. Somebody complaining about our coverage of Preston Bus Station was then retweeted by Preston Bus Station itself. We'll not go down that road there.
Who was complaining about our coverage of Preston Bus Station?
I'll have to go and look it up. We haven't been respectful enough of the brutalist architecture and the fact that it's a listed building, I believe.
It has been. It was listed fairly recently.
Daniel starred on
it. Yeah, it's listed fairly recently. But then somebody else I saw saying that it's too elegant to be brutalist. So, I mean,
I have to say, I thought that myself. I saw on the ITV coverage that it was named as the Brutalist Building, and then I looked it up and showed my husband, who's a lover of Brutalist architecture, and he said, that's not Brutalist. And then we saw the tweet this morning, and corrections corner all round.
Well, take it up with Preston Bus Station, I think, Lizzie. The stage was won by...
Thankfully, they've got their own Twitter, so I can.
You can. The stage was won by a brutalist of the cycling world, Primoz Roglic. But what are the other headlines today, please, Lionel?
Well, Richard, we signed off last night anticipating a sprint finish, didn't we? It was a sprint finish, but it wasn't a sprint finish for the likes of Sam Bennett and Pascal Ackermann and the rest, was it? I should have kind of known this because there was a start in Swansea, the Finnish town, in 2017, and the road that they came in on, that sort of sweeping suburban descent, was the road that the race went out on that occasion. Quite a steep flying run in, and then a drag up. And well, we saw, didn't we, loads of lingering shots of the very rocky, beautiful coastline with the high, jagged cliffs, and all of the towns are, you know, you really have to sort of dive down to get to these little coastal towns, a very pretty part of Spain. And it was another stage where we waited to the very end for the real action to happen. There was a breakaway with two Dutchmen in it, Pim Leekhart of Total Direct Energy and Alex Molinar of Burgos BH, a Belgian, Brent Van Moer of Lotto Sudal, a Spaniard, Jonathan Lastra of Caja Rural, and a Pole, Michal Paluta of CCC. And they got a gap of 12 minutes, which is by some margin the biggest breakaway of the Vuelta so far. It was De Koninck, Mitchelton Scott and Astana who were the principal teams on the front of the peloton bringing that gap back down. And we saw on one of the climbs, quite a long way from the finish, Sam Bennett in difficulty whilst his De Koninck Quickstep teammates were on the front. So it was starting to look that Bennett may not figure at the finish because it was quite a drag up to the line. On the run-in, we saw attacks from Willy Smit of BH Burgos. And once he was caught, Remy Cavagna and Ivo Oliveira went clear, and Cavagna dropped Oliveira over a climb, and the De Koninck Quickstep man was still away 5 kilometres, 4 kilometres before he was caught. And then we saw the uphill sprint to the finish, and Primoz Roglic was by far the fastest. He clinched his third stage win of the race ahead of Felix Großschartner of Bora Hansgrohe. Andrea Bagioli was third for De Koenig Quickstep. The first of the other GC riders was Dan Martin in seventh place. And, well, then there was a bit of confusion at the finish because the provisional results said that there'd been a split between Guillaume Martin in 8th place and Jasper Philipsen in 9th, which would have meant a 3-second time gap between Roglic and that second group. Now, crucially, Carapaz was in that second group and Hugh Carthy was a little bit further back. But then the results were all switched round and everyone was given the same time. And then finally, the 3-second gap between Roglic and the group containing Carapaz was reinstated, presumably after they'd looked at the video of the finish. And crucially, that meant that with the time bonus of 10 seconds that Roglic got for winning the stage, he closed the 13-second gap to Carapaz exactly. So the two riders are level on time, and Roglic will start tomorrow's stage back in the red jersey because he, of course, is ahead of Carapaz on points. So a bit like yesterday, all the drama was...
Corrections corner, Lionel. It's actually because of count back and the sum of positions in the race. So the total sum of positions is actually what makes one rider ahead of the other when there hasn't been a time trial yet. And at this point in the race, Roglic is on 112 and Carapaz is on 121. And obviously you want to be the lowest.
You're absolutely right. In fact, we talked about this during the Giro, didn't we? So Roglic's finishing positions, helped amply by those three first places, are what give him the red jersey tomorrow. Thanks, Lizzie. But
no red jersey for Lionel.
No red jersey. Just a red face, Richard. Just a red face. But it does mean that we're beautifully set up going into these two mountaintop finishes over the weekend. The two best riders so far in the race tied on time. When has this ever happened before?
Oh, it's never happened.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWaka. If you run a business, find out more at iWaka.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
iWaka have been supporting us since the spring when they became our title sponsors. And over the past few episodes, we've heard from Liv Denyer, who works for iWaka. She organised a charity bike ride from London to Brighton to raise money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust. Let's hear more from Liv about the ride itself, the charity they were raising money for, and the efforts being made to make iWaka a more diverse place to work.
Yeah, I guess the cycling really did bring together lots of different people that don't usually work together as well, which was really nice to see. We ended up splitting the three groups based on ability, which meant that, you know, it was less people picking people to go with that are usually in their team or that they're friends with. So it's quite nice to bring people together like that. We've actually raised quite a lot of money. iWaka matches donations from employees, and including that, we've raised about £12,000 so far, which is really, really exciting. We definitely didn't expect to raise so much. It's quite surprising how much of an impact a few people getting on their bikes can have. The Stephen Lawrence Trust works with communities and young people from disadvantaged and underrepresented backgrounds. And it's named after Stephen Lawrence, who was a Black British teenager that was murdered in a racially motivated attack, and whose murderers were only found guilty about 20 years on, I think. And then because that case took so long to convict the killers, there was an independent review taken into it, which concluded that the original police investigation had been impacted by institutional racism. I do think iWaka is a very diverse group of people. We have people from kind of all walks of life, different ages, different racial groups, different experiences, but I don't think there's any company out there that can say that they're doing everything in the best way possible, and iWaka is definitely looking to try and improve our how diverse and inclusive we are. There have been a few things that we've been doing this year, this cycle included in it. We've been having lots of speakers who are really well known in the D&I space come in and talk to us about how to try and make a company like ours more diverse and inclusive.
Iwaka specializes in making it easier for small businesses to borrow money for all sorts of reasons. So if you run a small business, check out iwaka.co.uk to see how they can help you too. That's iwoca.co.uk.
Well, as you said, Lionel, it was a relatively quiet day until that finish. And I think, as you say, we realised when Sam Bennett began to struggle, and there were no De Koenig Quickstep riders there to help him, that they were certainly planning for a different type of finish today, and went pretty close in the end with Bagioli, 21 years old, a very promising young rider, who beat Roglic at the Tour de Land, didn't he, earlier in the year, in a similar kind of finish. But Roglic today was absolutely, he won, he had so much time to sit up and celebrate. It was remarkable, really. And, when you looked at that finish, you thought, well, I thought, that it was one that should have suited Carapaz as well. A very punchy rider, Carapaz. Certainly capable of, we saw it at the Giro last year, we saw it at the Tour of Poland this year, of a very fast, punchy finish. But he was not really in that first line of finishers. And if we are anticipating a battle between Carapaz and Roglic, well, Roglic looks pretty strong. But I guess the other talking point, apart from Roglic's form, was that time gap. Some people struggle with this. There wasn't much daylight between Guillaume Martin and Jasper Philipsen, but the gap is 3 seconds. Could one of you explain why that is? Because not everybody is fully au fait with this.
Well, there are different rules for different types of finishes in a race, and there's one rule for a bunch sprint, and if there's more than 3 seconds gap between a rider in a bunch finish, then you will get a different time gap. The reason for that is to protect GC riders, kind of make it less likely that GC riders are at the front of a bunch sprint and then are causing crashes. So then the GC riders won't panic and they'll be a bit further back, because if there's a bit of a gap, the chance that it's 3 seconds when you're going that fast in a bunch sprint is pretty low. In a scenario like this, it's deemed that the finish is classed as small groups. When it's a small group finish, the gap between one rider and another rider, in order for there to be a time gap on the line, only has to be 1 second. In this scenario, Guillaume Martin had a gap behind him of 1 second or greater to Jasper Philipsen. That meant that the group containing Roglic and the first 8 riders was classed as one group, and the group containing Philipsen all the way down to 28th place Robert Power was the second group. So then the time gap of three seconds, it's not the gap between Guillaume Martin and Jasper Philipsen, it's the gap from Primoz Roglic when he crossed the finish line to Jasper Philipsen. And that's why you've got a 3 second gap and not just a 1 second gap.
Very well done, that, Lizzie. Very clearly explained. I remember having to explain that to Daniel and Ellis Bacon back in about 2007. They didn't realise that the time was taken on the rider at the front of the group ahead. And
I think sometimes pro cyclists don't realise, and this wasn't the case here. I think he was just caught out. But Hugh Carthy was really caught out because there was obviously more than a 1 second gap between Robert Power and him. And that meant that, 20 riders in front of him, Jasper Philipsen, that's 7 seconds between him and Hugh Carthy. And so then he's down 10 seconds behind Roglic. And that's, quite a lot of seconds to lose in the GC when, this Vuelta is really turning out to be a seconds game.
And that's, we've seen it in the Tour de France, haven't we? Do you remember, Richard, the stage to Epernay in the Tour de France when Julian Alaphilippe won and Geraint Thomas and Egan Bernal? I mean, the splits were small, but the time gaps were big because, but for the very point that Lizzie explained there, once the gap between group one and group two is more than a second, if the gap between the first rider of the first group and the first rider of the second group is in real time 7 seconds, then that's the time that is lost. And so as you get further down that elastic band, if you like, of riders coming up the hill, that the further back you are, the more jeopardy there is, because as Hugh Carthy has found out to his cost there, you know, a small gap between him and the rider in front is enough to give him another 7 seconds lost to Carapaz and 10 in total to Roglic. And so you can see just how sort of critical these punchy little uphill finishes can become when just small gaps can cost you a lot.
I don't know if it's worth mentioning how, I mean, Ineos just have no riders here. Like, Carapaz was left on his own with 4K to go. And they were protecting him really, really well. And they were making sure that he was at the front through all the tricky turns. But the really tricky turns were with 2K to go. And then he needed to be there at the bottom of the final climb with 1.5K to go. And he had no riders from 4K to go. Yeah, I mean, Roglic probably had 5 riders still. And actually, we've seen this on every kind of climb as well, because every time the road's gone uphill, Roglic has had, you know, on the day when Mike Woods won, Roglic was in the group with, I think, 3 other teammates. And then he had Sepp Kuss and George Bennett up the road. And Carapaz only had Amador. And I think when that gets into the mountains, how much can Amador do? Like, he can't do everything, and he's really being left to do everything. And, you know, if I was Roglic tomorrow, I would go out and I would isolate Carapaz from, you know, there's 2 really steep climbs before the first climb. I would isolate Carapaz and I would just send people off the front. And then George Bennett's not that far off on time. Just send him off and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we've spoken about. I mean, you know, Sosa was the next finisher for Ineos, over 3 minutes down. And Amador has been very visible. But yeah, you're right, Lizzie, that in the finale today, Carapaz was really left on their own. Can I just return briefly to the confusion over whether there was a gap or not? You know, we had a discussion last night about the subjectivity of the rule on dangerous riding or fair play, and the decision to relegate Sam Bennett. And we'll return to that a bit later on, because we had an interesting email today. But there can't, you know, it can't be that difficult to measure the time between one wheel and the next. And I don't understand why there was this confusion and why it took so long to decide what exactly had happened at the finish.
My feeling is that because this stage, before this stage, everybody, except for me, I have to say, because I called this on our WhatsApp group at 10 to 3, everybody was saying it was going to be a bunch sprint. And I really didn't see why, because you've got a 6% 1.5 kilometer climb and you've got a bunch of punchy power climbers like Roglic who want to get a time gap and want to get the bonus seconds. And anyway, I think because in everybody's minds, this was a sprint finish, they had the sprint finish rule in their mind as well. So, and the sprint finish rule, as I explained earlier, is a 3-second gap. So if they crossed the line and there was a 1-second gap between riders, which initially on the time thing came up as 3 seconds from Roglic to Jasper Philipsen, then they went, oh no, scrap that. We were on a 3-second bonus, 3-second time gap day to day. And then somebody said, well, hold on a second. This wasn't a brunch sprint. We didn't have a large peloton. We actually had small groups, in which case a different rule applies and it's a 1-second gap. Hence the reversion to the 3-second gaps in the end.
We did have an email during the tour, actually, Rich. Somebody asked why in this day and age are we not having, you know, absolutely accurate timing, and everyone gets the time they cross the line in. Well, I mean, on the sprint stages, that's obvious. It would cause absolute mayhem. It would be completely reckless to insist that, you know, everyone gets the time that they cross the line in, especially when, you know, if you watch a sprint finish with a whole bunch of 180 or 190 riders, you know, it can be quite a long time between the first rider and the last rider, even if there aren't any gaps in between along the way. So probably even on stages like this, it would be too reckless to you know, give everybody a different time. People would be scrapping for every single inch of road, wouldn't they?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our longtime supporters, and they support you in your cycling endeavours too. If you would like 25% off your Science in Sport sports nutrition products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the Code SISCP25 at the checkout. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Don't forget to stock up on your Turbo Plus products if you are spending time on the indoor trainer in the coming weeks or months. Now, over to Daniel Freib chatting to Lionel.
Daniel, where are you?
We are napalm in Asturias. We've crossed the border from Cantabria to Asturias. Didn't get stopped at the border, and we're slightly nervous every day when we move regions because we're hearing a lot about these lockdowns for non-essential travel. And we have managed to get into Asturias. We weren't, well, there were no blockades or anything like that. We weren't stopped, interrogated by police at any point. But yeah, that is happening, I think, at certain points when you leave and enter cities, certain cities.
Do you presumably get a free pass because you're travelling with the Vuelta, no?
Yes. We think we do, yes. Well, we're pretty sure we do.
So Asturias, all I can think of is the cloudy cider.
The cloudy cider, and what about the big, the cachopo? The
cachopo,
big,
well, of course.
Kind of like a veal, it's kind of like a veal slipper, deep fried in cheese.
That's right. How can I forget
what that would be like?
Oh, I just got a twinge in the arteries remembering that.
Yeah, usually the size of about three dinner plates for one portion of cachopo. And we've been told that the restaurant, our destination this evening, does a particularly good cachopo, but I think I might have to pass on it because, I've probably eaten about four times my body weight in meat thus far in the water. And, as I think discussed recently on the podcast, not a huge meat eater usually, but it's quite difficult to avoid here. If you're not a big meat eater or a big fish eater, and the water can be quite challenging.
Dear me, I mean, that's basically, that's nearly all of the food that's available.
Yes, and if you take chips out of the equation, then it indeed is all of the food that is available, pretty much. You might end up with a couple of pimientos de padrón, otherwise a couple of little green peppers, but not too many vegetables in evidence, generally.
Well, what about the race itself? Because Primoz Roglic got stage win number three, and they're level pegging going into two very difficult mountain stages.
Yes, and two big, well, probably decisive to a certain extent, mountain stages this weekend in Asturias. These are indeed the biggest, the hardest mountain stages of the race. La Farapona tomorrow, the Angliru on Sunday, and I was just reminiscing earlier today, well, just looking at when La Farapona has previously featured in the Vuelta. And of course, this climb and the Angliru are quite significant sort of way posts in Chris Froome's career. La Farapona in 2011, he was sort of on his way to, establish himself, having a breakthrough ride as a GC rider, and Juan Jose Cobo ripped things up on La Farapona, and Froome was working for Wiggins. And indeed, we also had the Angliru. So the same double header on consecutive days, Farapona and then the Angliru in 2011. And that was another pretty significant day for Froome. And he spoke to me about that this morning, actually, and about how significant that was in that Vuelta, and dropping Bradley Wiggins and being a little bit sort of in limbo, not really knowing what to do on the Angliru, whether to wait for Wiggins or help Wiggins or not.
We're not really anticipating Chris Froome being up there at the real sharp end of things over the weekend, but presumably somebody with his experience is going to be of some use, some benefit to Richard Carapaz.
The team hasn't looked quite as strong as we're accustomed to seeing in the off teams usually in Grand Tours thus far in the world. So I think Gabriel Rush, the DS tonight, hinted that Ivan Sosa has been slightly under par so far in the world, and they need him to come good in the big mountain stages. Amador is riding for three men, really. He's doing an awful lot of work, as we've seen him do for Movistar in previous seasons. He was touted as one of the best domestics and Grand Tour domestics in the peloton when they signed him in Ineos at the start of the year, and he's proven to be that. But Yeah, Froome's a bit of a question mark. I think he's been a bit disappointed in his own performance, or slightly frustrated in his own performance in the first week. He's having to get used to doing some of the sort of more menial jobs as a domestique riding on the flat. But I think from what I've been told by people in the team, he's warm to his task over the last few days, has sort of readjusted his expectations and was riding quite well on the front today. And I think he's getting better every day, whether by the last week, but whether by this weekend he's in a position to, you know, be Carapaz's last or penultimate man in the mountains, I'm not quite sure.
And what about Primoz Roglic? Because he's back in the red jersey tomorrow by the slenderest of margins, but he has won three stages. Really, the only misstep was on the stage to Formigal, where he lost the red jersey in the first place. Do you think there's
because
any
of a
signs?
Raincoat.
Because
a lack of dexterity with a cool zip or. Yeah, but as far as the actual pedaling is concerned, he looks pretty much bulletproof.
Do you think he's learned anything from the Tour de France, where, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight, especially with what happened to him on the final time trial to La Planche de Belfie? I mean, he didn't really make hay when the sun was shining enough, did he? He didn't make enough hay. Whereas here,
that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I think he probably will be favoured by the fact that he hasn't been in the red jersey the last few days, and that's probably brought home to him the need to, you know, carry on making up time. That said, I asked him this morning whether he would be happy with status quo after the weekend. So, if after the Farapon and Langliru, he didn't gain any further time, and then he went into the time trial next week. In the same position he said he would be, but you know, he already started eking out some seconds today, and yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how Jumbo-Visma use the team. I think I talked yesterday with the buff about how Ineos don't have the luxury of another guy on GC that they can fire off down the road. Presumably George Bennett is the main guy that Jumbo-Visma will be using in that role. What do you make of it so far, Napalm, the Carapaz Roglic battle?
Well, I mean, they look pretty evenly matched, I think. I mean, if it comes down to man against man in the final kilometres of either tomorrow's stage or the Angliru on Sunday, I think just about give the edge to Roglic, just because he looks a bit more explosive at the moment.
Yeah, and I think time bonuses have played a key role already and will continue to play a key role. Stan still could gain another 20, 30 seconds just from time bonuses. But, you know, however vulnerable people think he might be in the third week, he's in a short space of time, in a very concentrated period of 2 or 3 years, he's accumulated a lot of experience now, including in the World Cup last year when he was a little bit isolated on the last two mountain stages. And, I think that will stand him in good stead. Also, the third week of this Vuelta is unusually benign. And really, once the time trial is out of the way, then he has one final mountain stage to really focus on. And, I think at this stage, he looks like the favourite.
Yeah, I also think that in that final week, having a strong team around him will just minimise any risks of anything untoward happening, like another sort of, Formigal-style ambush from a few years back when Froome got caught out. I mean, or the crosswind stage from last year's race. I think the strength of his team will certainly play to his favour then. But listen, Daniel, I better let you go. I'm imagining that it's not that easy to find open restaurants in Spain at the moment. Certainly not one serving vegetarian cachopo.
Vegetarian cachopo, no, that hasn't. I don't think that's been developed yet. But I'd like to see it. In the meantime, I'm going to try to. I'll probably avoid the cachopo tonight. Maybe the fabada. You have fond memories of the fabada, don't you? Sort of. Asturian equivalent to cassoulet, of course.
It is.
And what's the difference between fabada and cassoulet? So the beans in fabada, they're white beans, And there's some blood sausage in there, which I don't think you get in Cassoulet, do you? But otherwise, quite similar.
Similar-ish, yeah, but it's really the black pudding is the thing in the Fabada. Yeah, it's nice, though. Had some last time I was there in Asturias, and it does go quite well with the cider as well. Anyway,
indeed it does.
We'll catch you in a few days, Daniel.
Thanks, mate, Barm.
Well, great to hear from Daniel. And before we move on to a few other bits and pieces, a reminder that if you would like to become part of the cycling podcast community at LACA, the bike insurance company, go to laca.co.uk and enter the code TCP. That will put you in the cycling podcast community and get you the fantastic LACA insurance for your bike or bikes and equipment. Now, moving on, we are going to hear from our audio diarist Nick Schultz in a moment or two, but you've been very busy, Lizzie, because you're doing a double shift today. You recorded an episode of Service Course earlier on with Tom Wally, and that has been released this evening. What's in it, please?
Absolutely. We have been looking at 3D printed technology this month. It's pretty cool, actually. Tom... and hopefully Daniel will be joining us next as well, seeing as he's had a very keen interest in tech.
You're not going to 3D print Daniel, I hope.
Oh, God, no. God help us all to have a second one. No, Tom was speaking to Dimitri Katsanis, who is the guy who 3D printed the TT bars for pretty much the whole of Ineos. He also has designed the Pinarello track bike, the British Cycling Lotus track bike. He's done a load of cool stuff. We've spoken to another 3D tech boffin who's told us all about how 3D printed bikes are the future. And finally, we spoke to Hexa, who are the only company making 3D printed helmets. So go and check that out over on the feed, which is available in any good quality podcast app.
Yes, Service Course is our monthly tech show, and it's a great listen. I haven't listened to this one yet, but I will do when I'm on my turbo trainer tomorrow. Now, before we crack on, let's hear from Nick Schultz, shall we? He's keeping an audio diary for us, Mitchell and Scott Ryder. They were very, very busy today trying to bring the brake back and set it up for Rob Stannard, their young Australian rider. I was keen to find out a bit more about him, so we asked Nick.
Stage 10 today. Another solid one out there. Could have probably been pretty relaxed as a breakaway with four or five guys went up the road and no one seemed interested in chasing. But actually, we had two good options for the finish today in Rob Stannard and Dion Smith. So we took it up. And in doing so, we hoped that we'd get a little bit of support from other teams. And we did, from Quickstep and also Astana. So it made for a really hard day, as when we took it up, it was a 12 and a half minute gap, I think. So we had a lot of work to do. It's the type of roads where when you're riding the front, you can actually also hurt the people in the wheels because it's quite twisty and turny up and down. So a good day to be riding the front. It's kind of hard for everyone in that sense. Rob Stannard delivered a top five today. He's a young up-and-comer on the team. Super talent. Can do everything, actually. He's a really fast sprinter, a really, really good climber, and, super punchy. So he was top 10 in the bunch sprint yesterday, and then we saw today on the uphill finish that he was fifth there. So he's super versatile very much fits the mold of this younger generation coming through. I think we'll see a lot more of him, if not at this welter, in the coming years. And I think he's going to win a lot of big races, and he'll be a protected rider at this team for sure. As he's just so versatile, and I think perhaps not certain which path he goes down. He's he was right up there in the baby Giro with guys like Almeida and riders like this, and Vlasov, I think, as well. So, you know, the potential there for stage racing GC is also present. I don't think he quite knows, but he's certainly versatile and can do a lot of things, and it was an excellent ride from him today the shoulder of that pressure of the team working for him all day and then delivering a top five. So that was excellent to see, and we're really happy with it.
Hi guys, it's Scott Davis checking in after stage 10 of the Vuelta. So we're past the first rest day and sort of into the second phase of the race now. And yeah, so far we're having a really good race with Wout Poels. He's been doing great recently. He's sitting ninth on GC at the moment, after a few top tens on a few stages. So we're all in for Wout, trying to support him as best as we can. And like I said, he's having a really good race so far, and still a long way to go until Madrid. Today, stage 10 was a bit of a strange one. It looked like it would be quite a straightforward day to begin with, once the break had gone. And then Mitchelton started to ride, which was a little bit unexpected given the time gap at that point. And then, yeah, in the end, it came together for a bunch kick of some sort, even though it was mostly the GC guys that fought it out on that last climb. But yeah, so far so good, and we'll carry on as we are, and aim to support Wout as best we can for the GC. All right, thanks guys, cheers.
Well, should we just return to your point, Lizzie, earlier about Richard Carapaz and the support he's got from Ineos Grenadiers? Because you're absolutely right, there is a bit of a dearth of support for Carapaz at certain points in the race. And when you look at the lineup, I know they've obviously lost two riders so far in the race. They lost Brandon Rivera very early, and Michal Goas was pulled out a few days ago. Andre Amador has been the most visible. Ivan Sosa, Dylan Van Baarle, and Cameron Wurf. And Chris Froome, of course, are the other support riders. But
I would say Wurf has been worth his weight in gold. He's his job has been pretty early in the stage. He's been doing quite a lot, I think.
Yeah, and Chris Froome has been visible as well, but perhaps that's because he's Chris Froome, and he has been doing his work earlier in the stages than you would expect. Certainly, well, you wouldn't expect a fit Chris Froome to be working for somebody else necessarily, would you? But of course, he's on his way back from that terrible injury at the Dauphiné, 18 months or so ago now, isn't it? But there's a real difference between Ineos and Jumbo-Visma here. Jumbo-Visma have brought riders who have already gone through the Tour de France, and we'll have to see in the second half of the race whether that works in their favour or not. But what's your feeling on it, Lizzie?
I mean, the thing is here that Jumbo-Visma have clearly got their A-team. And if you think back to Tours de France of old, and you look at the dominance that Sky at the time had, and they always had, you got to the mountains and they would always have a train of five or six riders. And even right till the end, they would still have, you know, a couple of domestiques with their GC man. And you just haven't seen that. I mean, at the Giro, yeah, Rohan Dennis was the only one who could climb with Teo, and only really in two of the stages. And here, Andre Amador is the only one that's the last man there for him. And it really leaves him isolated for a long time. Whereas so often, Roglic has got so many people around him. But having said that, Jumbo-Visma have got six of the riders from their tour team here at the Vuelta. And that is a huge amount of fatigue to load onto a rider. And we've obviously seen with Tom Dumoulin already that he's really burnt out. And so he's had to leave the race because of that. And we're only halfway through. We just don't know what's going to happen in that final part of the race. And it can really come down to the last day. And, you know, you only have to have a small crack to suddenly get a really, really big time gap. So, yes, Ineos have less men. And really that does open Carapaz up to potential attacks from, well, isolation and attacks. But perhaps are they fresher men? Because Ineos only have two riders who've come from their tour team over to their Vuelta team. I guess, yeah, we'll have to wait and see. But I think the next two days are going to be a really, really big test for Ineos. And if I were Jumbo-Visma, I would do everything to isolate Carapaz as early as possible. You'd probably have five or six men with Primoz Roglic, and you'd only have one with Carapaz. And then in no time at all, he would have no riders left to support him. And then, yeah, then it's an easy game to play.
A lot of people listening might think, well, look, it's going to be Roglic versus Carapaz in the final few kilometres of these uphill finishes anyway. What difference does it make? I mean, it makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. I mean, tomorrow you've got two really steep climbs pretty far out from the final climb. If you send George Bennett off on the penultimate climb and he gets, you know, he's with a group of strongish riders, he can get a really big gap. And then if he's the virtual red jersey on the road, then Carapaz is literally the only man left to chase, because everybody else is going to look to him as equal first on GC and say, well, it's your responsibility. And then that puts him in a really, really difficult position. So if I was Jumbo-Visma, I would go out all guns blazing, go on the attack and really put them on the back foot. And that's where, you know, so often it's people say, oh, is cycling a team sport? But you need to watch Grand Tours like this and you really see how important it is to have a strong team there.
And it's not just riding and being a familiar jersey around you and knowing that you've got that security. If anything, I mean, a puncture or mechanical problem, you've got a teammate with you to either give you a wheel or help you get back up to the position you're in before. But all sorts of other little things, like just making sure that you've got food and drink from the car, and especially when the groups get split up over climbs, it does get complicated.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you're desperate for a bead on and it's, I don't know, within 10k to go and then feeding has stopped, so usually in a race feeding stops at 25 or 20k to go. Sometimes the commissaires will give special dispensation because it's the finish is up a climb, so therefore the time taken to cover that distance takes a lot longer. Or if it's a really, really hot day, sometimes they leave feeding open until the last 5k. It can really depend. But the point is, like you say, when the race explodes, there's riders everywhere. The team cars are blocked. They're not allowed to move up to the top riders. So if you're desperate for a bottle, because remember, you don't want to climb with an extra kilo in your in your bike. So you chuck your bottle, you just have half a bottle, you use it all and you're dying for a drink. Just those small things, having someone there to give you that, having someone there to say, are you okay? Stay on my wheel. It makes a big, big difference. And that's the kind of support that Roglic is going to have that Carapaz won't.
Well, the next 2 days are going to be really fascinating. It's interesting to look at the Ineos roster and wonder who they might have brought. You know, one or two ruled out by the classics, I think, the likes of Luke Rowe and Pavel Sivakov. You know, had a very tough Tour de France, but a fit Pavel Sivakov would have been a great ally. Mikhail Kwiatkowski, even Eddie Dunbar. You know, I think they've lost a couple of riders with injury. There was a clash with the classics as well, but yeah, it could be a real decisive factor over the remaining days and the next couple of days in particular. Before we sign off tonight, I want to read a little bit of an email from Quinn White, Assistant Professor, Philosophy Department, University of Nebraska, Lincoln. It's a long email. I'll not read all of it. He says something about the podcast to start. He says the rotating cast of guest hosts has been a real delight, so that's nice to know. With the sprint regulations of the last few days, you all have talked a bit about what the vagueness of the rules and what Richard has repeatedly called their subjectivity. For whatever it's worth, I wanted to offer a bit of perspective from a philosopher. In short, I don't think that what race jurors are up to is subjective at all, but it does involve a use of practical judgment, the principles of which cannot be fully articulated ahead of time in a written rule book. I think it's worth drawing a distinction between the idea that the race jury is making a judgment and making a subjective decision of some kind. Here's what I have in mind. Imagine the two of us are discussing cassoulet. You think it's delicious, I think it's revolting. Is one of us wrong? No, it's a matter of taste. It's a really interesting email. I'm not going to read it all out, but thanks very much, Quinn. It got me thinking, certainly, and about the difference between subjectivity and what was it?
Well, perhaps a better word would be interpretation then.
Interpretation of the rules, I think.
Applying the written rule to the scenario. I think
the rules in some of these things are deliberately vague to allow the judges to bring their own interpretation to it and to really look at the context, because there are so many moving parts in a bunch sprint in particular that I don't think you can have really clear rules about what is and isn't allowed, because something can be allowed in a certain situation and not in another. And I think that's just one of the complexities of the sport. But anyway, shall we wrap up for this evening? We've got a big weekend ahead of us, haven't we? So we should get our rest before then. you'll be joining us again, Lizzie. Look forward to that. Thank you very much.
I will. I'm here for the best weekend. Yeah, we've got some steep climbs tomorrow, Anglerieu on Sunday, and then I'm here again for the time trial on Tuesday. But as we know, time trials are always boring.
Well, yeah, are they? Yeah. Yeah, well, let's see, shall we? If Rog knocks off the next two stages as well, then it could be quite boring, but let's hope for the best. Thanks, Lizzie.
What about thank yous, Richard?
Oh, yes.
Goodness me. I mean...
an amateur. Before we go, some thank yous to friends of the podcast. And we have an episode, a special episode coming up for Friends of the Podcast. It will be released when the Grandest Tour finishes a week on Sunday. That's an hour-long conversation with Theo Gegenhart talking through his Giro win, really from the moment he wasn't picked for the Tour de France up to Milan. So that was a very enjoyable chat, actually, and there was a lot of detail in there, which I didn't know. And yeah, it's great to hear the winner tell his story. On Monday, you'll hear a bit of that interview because our final episode of Kilometer Zero, powered by Zwift, will be released. And it will be the story of the Giro as told by Theo Gegenhart, Jai Hindley, who was second, and Luke Roberts, his Sunweb Sports director. We'll also have our own kind of key moments. Lizzie has picked hers. We'll hear from me, Lionel, Daniel, Francois, and Ian Boswell as well. So that will be coming out on Monday. But if you'd like to sign up as a friend of the podcast and listen to the full Theo Gegenhart conversation, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. And from me, a big thanks to A.A. Van Eisendoorn. I hope that's correct. Eisendoorn. Dan Smerniki. William Martino. We know William because he was the friend of the podcast whose idea last year was picked to make into a friend special. Danny Hall, Stephen Taylor, David Phillips, Philip Page, and Neil Bruce.
And a big thank you to Anthony Cartledge, Jamie McCanny, James L. Buchanan, Izzy Ronald, Simon Tyrrell, and Todd Troutman.
And finally, a big thank you from me to Seb Marshall, Mark Carter, John Paul Murphy, Daniel Pritchett, John James, Mike Norton, and The Old Barn.
The Old Barn, thank you very much. It'll be Preston bus station next.